This is episode number 38 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. This show is hosted by Dan Benjamin. That's me. And of course, by beloved by everybody, the godfather of the web, Jeffrey Zeldman. This episode is sponsored by SourceBits.com. They provide software design and development services for iOS, Android, Mac, and the web. SourceBits is at the bleeding edge of emerging technologies, and their experience and track record make sure that your app will be amazing, well-tested, and visually stunning. And they'll save you money by getting it done right the first time. You can check them out at SourceBits.com. And we'd also like to thank MailChimp. They've done it again. You can now send 12,000 emails a month. I don't understand this. 12,000 emails a month to a list of up to 2,000 subscribers. And you can integrate with all of your favorite web services, all the ones you already use. You can mix and match their templates and features, integrations to your needs. It's like your own personal publishing platform. So check them out at MailChimp.com. And without any further ado, Jeffrey Zeldman, how are you today, sir?
I'm fantastic, Dan, and I'm very excited about our guest.
We have a lovely guest. It's Jason Snell.
Lovely.
Jason Snell from Macworld.
That is not an adjective that is always used to describe me. So
it's not used enough, I would say, in describing.
Should well be, put. Yes. So Jason, you're the editorial director of
Macworld. That is my current title, yes.
And you were editor before that, I believe.
I have had every title. Editorial director, I like to say that my previous title, I was editor-in-chief and editor. And at one point, I was executive editor, and that was a great job because that's the job where you get to execute the editors. But they promoted me, and I can't do that anymore, sadly. I started as an intern, actually, at Mac User, so I've had every title, literally every single title. I've run out now.
Has Macworld really become Mac User in a way?
Well, for the people out there who remember back to, you know, 97 and before,
right,
when there was the Macworld and Mac User magazines, the fact is that, yeah, within a couple of years, everybody who was working at Macworld after the two merged, really everybody left was most of the people were just gone. And the few who remained from the previous magazines were Mac User people. And I've been at Macworld so much longer than I was at Mac User. But, you know, yeah, it's me and people
Andy.
Like Chris Breen, you know.
Right,
so in many ways, yeah, I think there's more of the Mac User DNA in Macworld today than the pre-97 Macworld.
And before the merger and before you came on, Macworld, let's just talk about the magazine first. Mac User, the magazine, was kind of a little bit aggressive, in your face. It had this vibe of being slightly unofficial. And Mac User had this actually was official, correct? At some point. What I remember the first time I bought my first Mac, I got Macworld for free, or well,
right?
Not, yeah.
Well, neither of them were ever official, like Apple approved. But Macworld was the one that kind of came out of deals with Apple. Like there was a Macworld issue at the launch event for the Mac, which means that they had gotten access to the original team and had made this sort of undated issue that would be released at some point when they did their announcement. And then they had the deal with, yeah, you get the card in the box that said you can get an issue of, you can get a subscription to Macworld. So it was sort of more of a business deal. It wasn't the official Macintosh magazine, but Macworld was always number one and Mac User was always number two. And there was a little bit of that kind of Rebel Alliance kind of feel, or just
right,
a feeling that we were, that at Mac User, that we were looser than Macworld. And certainly when I came over and met the people who were at Macworld during that period, they were more, it was funny, you'd never expect that we were probably the most alike in terms of our jobs of anybody on the planet, right? How many people
right,
write a monthly magazine about the Mac? And
right,
yet we couldn't have been more different in the approach despite that, which was crazy. They were very, very serious and they were into the Mac, but I think they were more committed to being a kind of a media or magazine professional. And the Mac User people were a little bit more like hardcore. And I think you see that now when you look around in the Mac world, that the people from that period who are still, you know, writing about Apple are generally the people, not always, not entirely, but generally it's the people from the Mac User side of the fence and not the people from the Macworld side.
Right, right. Some people, like, you still have Jim Hyde, I think Dory Smith still writes for you.
Tom Negrino. Tom Negrino. Still do some work for us. And then and I think Ted Landau maybe was on the Mac User side. I mean, the writers, actually, it's a much better mix. The editorial
right,
teams, there are very few of those people Actually, I think even still in the tech publishing business from the Macworld editorial team. Although Galen Grumman, who was the editor at Macworld at that point, is now at InfoWorld. He's just downstairs, in fact.
Now, for the purposes of this show, I'm going to want to talk a lot about your website and digital. But I just to get just a little bit more Macworld flavor, what's it like writing an independent, somewhat irreverent, but very committed magazine for a company that's at the same time so completely awesome and also so secretive?
Well, you know, a lot of people make assumptions that, and they think that I do know about all the secret stuff that Apple's doing and I just can't say, and I'm very good at playing coy. And the reality is that I used to say Apple sometimes will give us software in advance under embargo, under NDA, but they never do it with hardware. I actually can't say that anymore because I did get the iPad a couple days before it came out to review. And I did get the Verizon iPhone about a week before the embargo lifted and got to write a review of that. So it occasionally happens. But, you know, it's for products that have sort of already been announced but haven't come out. The stuff that's totally secret is totally secret. So right. It's a challenge. We try to have a good relationship with Apple, as lots of people who cover Apple do, because you want to have that good relationship. You want them to understand what you're doing and know you and trust you to the point where they'll give you info. But at the same time, you've got to assert your independence. And if you don't like something, you got to say it. And that's a tricky line to walk. There's a perception among some people that we're the Apple approved media organ, and maybe I even work for Apple, and it's just not true, right. And it's they're a challenging company to work with, but the great thing about them is that they do make these interesting and generally amazing products, and you can't argue with the success rate. I mean, it was different in 1997 when right. people said, oh, you're covering Apple and they're kind of about to die, but the last 10 years you just look at the track record and what other single tech company would you want to cover at this point? Right. Apple is where all that kind of action is happening. So it's a challenge to work with them sometimes, but the subject matter is great.
It's funny. I was talking to Craig Hockenberry, who I know you also know. And Craig is works with Icon Factory. He's the programmer of Twitterific for our listeners and other apps and things. And he was saying, at a certain point, he was a developer. And then at a certain point, he decided to, this Apple stuff is cool, I'll do this. And he got excited by the Mac, and it's made a complete difference in his life, because it might have been a losing bet and he might have picked the wrong thing. But as it turned out, it worked out very well for him, and also clearly, Jason, for you. Do you think that, does the website, the timeliness of with a publication, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, when you have to go to print, no matter how much you rush and everything, you're always a bit late. And with Apple so tightly controlling its news, it's kind of hard to write an article for a print magazine about like the new iPhone when you know that that article is going to come out. The magazine will come out like at least a month after the TV news got the news. And so does the website help you with the timeliness of the website? And do you see the website and magazine having different functions?
They definitely have different functions. I mean, they're different. Each one is its own medium, right? And they do have different things that they do well and that they do poorly. I would say that the magazine is better because of the website. It was actually a long and painful process over more than 5 years, I think, to really pivot the editorial staff from being print-focused to being web-focused, like truly not just a few people off on the side doing stuff on the web, but having everybody think of the web as their turf. And, but I think after we did that, we actually won a few magazine awards for the print magazine. And there was skepticism that if you gave that attention to the web, print would suffer. But in the end, I think the content has been better that we put in the magazine for a few reasons. One of them is that the web is merciless in terms of time. So we could, back in the old days, in those old Mac user and Macworld days, there'd be a product announcement and you'd be going to press in a week and you'd say, we're just going to put in a little note that they announced it and we'll give them the details in a month. Well, you can't do that. You can't. Yeah. And then more than that, we would have written a story that would have been sort of the specs and stuff like that and said that's what people want to know. We can't do that either, not only in print, but we can't really even do that on the web because everybody's doing that too. So the web has forced us to do more analysis faster, frequently asked questions and what does this mean and where are they going and how is this going to work instead of just here's what Apple says the product is. And we have to do that in like a day or a day and a half. We have a very short window to get all of that stuff up on the website. Well, you know, even if the magazine's shipping in 2 days, we've got raw material in terms of all these web stories that we can cut down and remix a little bit and stick into the magazine. So as a result, the magazine's actually, you know, it's not timely in the sense of the web because you have to print the issues and put them on a truck and or in mail them out. But it's more timely and I think more analytical about these product announcements than it used to be. It allows us to say right. you know, everything you wanted to know about the iPhone rather than there is an iPhone, which is what we would have said in the past. So it's good.
You become like Newsweek or the Daily News versus – I'm sorry, Newsweek or The Economist versus the Daily News. You don't have to rush out the scoop in the print. Instead, the print can look back and you can say – as you often do on your front page, Apple's changing this, or you know, Apple's changing the way the store works. Is this a good thing or bad thing for users? You get to be so the magazine feels like more archival, analytical thought pieces, and the web is the latest news.
Right, exactly, because that's what print is better at, and also there, you know, we can't compete on timeliness in print because you just can't. Even if you time it right, you can't. So you have to take a step back and say the pictures are pretty. Also, the you know, people talk about curation on the web. Print is curation too. I mean, in many ways, we post 20, 30 stories a day on Macworld.com, and it's far more content than we could ever fit in the magazine. We have 62, I think, pages of editorial and print, which has been basically the same for about 10 years. Right. And I would imagine on the web, if you tried to make a magazine of everything we write in the course of a month, it would be like 300 pages. It would be – so we curate, right? So in many ways, what the print magazine is for people who don't want to go to the website, are not going to read 30 stories a day. You know, we're handpicking the best stuff and kind of making it look good and putting in nice photographs. And that's what print is good at.
So Jason, how much is shared then between the magazine and what's online? Are there any things that you do that are just only going to appear in the magazine or vice versa?
I think the idea is that everything ends up on the website. And sometimes people ask me, well, you know, you left this out. Is that part of your strategy? And it's generally it's things like that back page column by John Gruber. You didn't post for 3 months. Is there a reason for that? And the answer is we forgot. I mean, that I think we don't purposefully hold that stuff out of the web because it's in print.
Right.
You know, there might be some delays, you know, but it's not, yeah, it's not a strategy to kind of like say, well, if we put it all, if everything we do in print is on the web, then nobody will want to read print, because I don't think that withholding of content is going to, that's not a reason people read print. People are going to read print for lots of reasons about why print is good. The fact that all the articles are on the website is not going to be the thing that makes them say, forget this.
Right. So you don't have a system in, it sounds like there's a lot of hard labor involved. You don't have a system where you check a box on the piece to, you know, to denote that it's going to the web. You check another box to note that it's going to the magazine, or you automatically set, you know, publish this 2 days after the magazine comes out in print. What you don't have a CMS that does everything for you.
Right. The back page column and my editor in chief column in the front and stuff like that sort of often will be written and some features are this way where the print deadline comes up first and you end up doing it in print first and then putting it on the web. Mm-hmm. They kind of fall through the cracks a little bit, but that's because we have a web first production system. So we don't have, back in the old days when I was actually the online editor at MacUser, you know, you'd lay everything out and then you'd pull it out and put it on the web. And we don't do that. Everything we do, we put into a CMS. You know, everything we're generating in HTML. Everything that gets pasted into our CMS is HTML. Some of us work in Markdown and then convert it to HTML when we paste it in, but it's HTML. And cool. So that's all the content starts out that way. And then we have a workflow where people can extract the HTML and we import it into InDesign, and it's got tag mapping that tags it to our styles, and then we cut it down. The problem comes when you're going the other direction, because we don't have a print to web flow built, because we basically don't need it. Everything is flowing web to print. So that's when I end up saying, oh, right, Gruber wrote that column. I should post that, because I just, you know, I turned it in for print and it's sitting on my hard drive and I just haven't put it in HTML yet. And then I say, shucks, and I go post it. But it's not a strategy. It's more that it's a symptom of the fact that we are so focused on the web to print workflow and not the reverse.
Let's talk about some of the things publishers are scared of that you don't seem to be scared of. Publishers,
well, right. Zombies.
Well, I'm scared of ghosts. I'll be honest. I am scared of ghosts. For instance, you have paywalls. You have free stuff for the iPad. You have free stuff for the iPhone. You have free stuff on the web. You have a magazine that you sell. You have a couple of iPhone apps that you sell. You have like a special edition complete magazine that you sell as an iPhone app. You don't seem to be worried that the free stuff is cannibalizing the for sale stuff. Am I right? Or do you feel that these things are reinforcing each other, or are you just testing stuff and at any point you might go, gosh, we really got to put up a paywall now, or this isn't working?
I think it's a big combination of a little bit of all those things, right? I mean, I think there is a concern that if you give everything away, the economics are problematic, that you risk if the ad model doesn't work, whether it's because people aren't buying ads or because the way that ad buying happens changes or because nobody wants to see the ads and because, so therefore they're ineffective. You know, a lot of publishing companies are run by people who come up from the sales side. The editors don't generally end up as the CEO, right? And so they're very focused on, out of the gate at least, on ad sales. And what happened in the last economic downturn, I think, is that everybody got a little shot of the old time religion of, you know, what's also good is when people give you money for stuff. Right. You know, your customers are your readers and not your advertisers. And the truth is, you know, in most cases, it's a mixed model and your customers are both. But it's really easy for, and I'm not saying this about my company, I think in general, it's really easy for publishers to be run by the approach that the advertisers are the customer and the readers are eyeballs to be sold to, and they're not a customer. And I think that is a mistake. I think there are people who will pay for your content and that you need to try different stuff. So we did this, we're doing this Macworld Insider thing, which is basically for $20 a year, you get some site features, including the fact that you can turn off the ads. And we did the calculations and it's like, well, you know what happens if everybody buys it and we have no ad revenue? And the answer is we would have more revenue from people at that point than we would from the ad revenue, and it wouldn't matter. We'd be sitting pretty. And so you try different stuff. And on the iPad, I have to admit our initial plan for our iPad app was for it to be a little more aggressive with a paywall. And then we ran into what many publishers did with Apple, was some conflicting advice from Apple about what the rules were. And we actually did some things specifically, bent over backward, because we felt we were following the guidelines. And it turned out that the guideline we were following was about to change. And so our app got rejected and they said, no, we want you to do it this way. And in order to get the app out, we ripped some of that stuff out, at least temporarily. And so now, you know, we're going to have to find a different approach, because we do want to have this mixed model where you can get some scale, where you've got a lot of people reading it and that's how the ad model works, but also have the ability to let people pay, maybe to get some extras, maybe to turn off some of the ads. And that's all part of the experiment. So who knows where it'll go. So I wouldn't say that I'm not scared. I just feel like the worst thing you can do is not try stuff and just kind of pretend that the problem isn't there, right? I mean, sticking your head in the sand doesn't do anything. So we're trying stuff.
Go ahead, Jeffrey. Sorry.
I was just going to say it is a really interesting time, and it is a time of trying things. For instance, I'm sure you're familiar with Dribbble, the visual design community. And Dribbble is advertising supported, but it's a private community. So if you're in advertising, what, you know, in theory, advertisers want as many qualified eyeballs as possible.
Right.
And the keeping it limited definitely helps with qualified, but it lowers the eyeballs. And you know, so Dribbble has a mandate to keep the community small so that it's really a high quality community. But at the same time, there and it sounds like you wrestle with the same things. Do you get fried when Apple changes the rules after you've maybe spent? Because publishing margins, from everything I know about the business, are not. You're not an oil company. If you have a certain amount of money set aside to develop an app, and you've spent that money, and then Apple changes the rules, you may not be able to release that app, or you might have to. ask people to work free, or I don't know what you would do.
Right. We're definitely not an oil company, although IDG, you know, which is a privately held company which owns Macworld, because it's private. I mean, its finances are obviously private. They do a very good job of managing our margins, and we are profitable, and we're not one of these kind of hemorrhaging money newspaper kind of companies, and that's good. And then, you know, to the credit of the president of IDG, he actually said, I'm gonna encourage you guys and give you a little seed money to work on this so that we can test this out and see what the issues are, right? Which is smart. Instead of doing some massive company-wide thing, they're like, hey, Macworld, try this out and tell us what you learned, which is what we've been doing, and we've been reporting back to them. But yeah, you know, the Apple rejection thing, I mean, it was kind of like the worst Christmas ever, because it actually came while I was on my Christmas holiday. It came right before Christmas, and we got this rejection, and the problem was that it was obviously still formulating, and some of this became very clear actually when the daily announcement happened, and the day before that, where Apple explained, oh, well, here's what our new policy is about what you buy in the app and what you buy outside. And several people said, well, that isn't that isn't that different than what you've been saying all along, which is you can't buy something in an app and have it be delivered outside, that it's only for stuff in the app? And they said, well, I think they said nothing about that, but the implication is that that's not the rule anymore, and that you can offer it in both places. And that's what we ran into. Our rejection was essentially saying, we went to the trouble of saying, Apple says we can't offer our Macworld Insider in the app, so we'll create a special thing in the app. And Apple came back and basically said, no, don't create a special thing, just sell, which we would have done in the first place had we known. So,
right.
Yeah, it was frustrating, and it required us to not just spend money on changing the app, but in shifting gears, we wanted that app out. And, you know, we barely got it out for Macworld Expo. It was essentially a month and a half late because of all of this complication. And we ended up saying, you know what, we're going to release it for free. We're not going to have a paywall that comes down at some point. We're just going to get it out there. So that's changed our strategy. We will do something when we end up putting premium features in there that you have to pay for. It won't be the same strategy that we had in December. And that's, it may be a much better strategy actually in the long run, but it's different, and that's because the rules were just kind of unclear. And you know, you roll with it. That's what you have to do. I think Apple, the good news is Apple was trying to figure out ways to make this work better and make more sense in some ways for publishers. And in the end, I think their rule changes might be very good for us, maybe bad for Amazon, but we'll see. But probably pretty good for us in the long run.
I want to take a step back for a second and ask a question about advertisers specifically, because, you know, as you and Jeffrey were talking about, you have both the website and a print magazine. A lot of the advertisers you would think would want to be in both places. They would want to be in print and they would want to be on the web. And I'm curious to know, do advertisers tend to favor one or the other? Do they report back and you know, I mean, maybe you can't say because this gets a little dicey, maybe. But
well, also I'm the editorial guy, right?
So yeah.
I've got a counterpart who is the head of sales, and we both report to the CEO.
Okay.
So you know, we have one sales team, and they sell all their clients, and I am sure that they're selling them on everything we do. I'm sure they're selling them on the WebKit version that we serve to iPhones and Android phones. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they're selling them on the full HTML website. I'm sure they're selling them on print. And obviously they were selling them on our iPad app, because, you know, Epson ended up being the launch sponsor for that. So that,
right.
they're an advertiser and other means. So I think some people love print and some like both, and some hate print and think that it's dead and that they should only advertise online. And in the end of the day, I think that's one of the challenges of being a salesperson, is that they've got to roll with it and say,
right,
well, no, you really want both. And then you've got to accept that maybe they're only going to buy one or the other. And it's a tough job. I was thinking about this the other week, that, you know, the salespeople are a different breed from editors. And I, not to make horrible generalizations, but the salespeople strike me as the people who were like popular in high school, and the editors strike me as the people who weren't. And I always thought about that. And I didn't really realize the reverse of that, which is, as editors, you know, we are sort of visible and front and center on our brands, whereas the salespeople are the ones who are not really visible, and they have to deal with rejection every single day, because selling things is so tough, and so much of it is about rejection. Yeah. And it's this funny flipping that it's the like popular, successful people from high school who are still, you know, still have nice teeth and a good haircut, but they but boy, selling stuff is tough. I would never want to do that. So I feel for them, because they are totally tangential, but you know, isn't it kind of funny? Because you know, they have to. That's what sales is, apparently, is being rejected every single day. All I have to do is deal with angry commenters.
So how do you deal with that, though? How do they deal with that? The advertiser expectations. Some people in the chat room are asking about that. You know, response and analytics from advertisers across multiple media. I mean, if I were to go and buy a spot on Macworld.com. I could probably get click counts and reports and click-throughs and come up with a metric, whereas if I bought the same equivalent ad or this equivalent spend in the magazine, is it as easy to know? And I ask this because I think people all across our listener base have, in many cases, websites, but they also do print, and I do podcasting, and I'm always curious about this. How do you know? How do you measure those things that aren't click-throughs these days when that's the model everybody expects? Still?
Well, it's brutal, isn't it? Because the whole model of TV advertising and magazine advertising is about branding.
Yeah.
And, you know, the old mantra of one of my former bosses was, you know, you must be known to be considered, and then you must be considered to be bought. And the idea there is, you know, Vizio is an example I like to mention, which is, what the hell is Vizio? Vizio is the number one TV manufacturer now. And how do they do that? And the answer is, well, they made products that were pretty cheap and they put them in Costco. But that why wouldn't Vizio be a brand that's like Sampo or something, some brand you've never heard of and you don't trust? And the answer is, they advertised. And did they have click-throughs on their ads? And there were no click-throughs on all their TV ads. But what it meant was, it gave them this kind of veneer of trust and respectability. And, well, they've obviously got enough money to buy advertising, so they must be a real outfit. And so then you walk into Costco and you see a Vizio TV and you buy it. Well, that's the kind of thing that is impossible to measure through something like click-throughs, and is much more hazy. And there's an argument to be made that that's actually bogus and it doesn't actually work and it's just a sales job. But I do wonder, I do think we've kind of shifted it to the other side now, which is, if it doesn't result in an immediate click and purchase, then it basically is worthless and I shouldn't pay you for it. That seems kind of like madness too. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, with print, you could just say, well, you know, put in an 800 number and maybe you'll be able to count the calls. But there's basically no immediate response. And the web is all the chickens coming home to roost, where they know exactly how many clicks they got on their ad. Right. And,
but some things you're not going to buy from a click. We advertise our conference and people are spending hundreds of dollars on it. Nobody clicks the ad and goes, hey, that sounds like a pretty good conference, I'll buy it right now. You know,
Advertising on the web right now, it's brutal, because there are people who get that and people who don't get that. And even within companies, right, you've got executives and marketing people who totally get the idea that this is not all about clicks. And then you've got people at agencies and who are lower down, who they're the ones with the budgets and they're the ones saying, sorry, I can't do it because you're not giving me the clicks. And that's what my boss wants.
I think it's just direct mail versus brand advertising. Round two. I mean, if you think about it that way, I mean, there was a time, let's say in the 1980s, where if you work in an ad agency, there'd be a client who'd say, I just want direct mail pieces because they have a little discount coupon code and I can track that and I know where my dollars are going. And then there's people like, you know, Coke and Pepsi who spend millions and as a result, when I'm in the restaurant, I'll say, Coke, please. And they'll say, is Pepsi okay? Right. So why are we even having that conversation? Sugar water with bubbles. But we're having a conversation because the brand advertising has changed the way we think about these products. So, I want to ask, you have iPod apps, you have a mobile site, or you have a mobile version of your site.
Right.
You have the traditional website. Where does the impetus for apps and site versions come from? Is that from sales or editorial?
Here it comes. I keep waiting for you to revisit that piece that you wrote about misguided apps versus the web, which I have answers prepared for that. But anyway, I think the impetus for the different web versions and products and things like that, honestly, I can't say for everything. From us, I think more of it comes from editorial, but and also from our, not really from sales, maybe from our kind of business people as well, who are looking at
business development.
Yeah. I mean, or product management, you might want to call them. I don't know. Definitely, we talk about that. And since we're the closest to the customers, as the editors, to the audience, we'll say it that way. Who's the customer? To be determined.
But,
For instance, we will say, you know, the iPhone is out and our big website is kind of lame on the iPhone. We should do a WebKit version that looks better on the iPhone. And they'll say, oh, that's a good idea. And then we'll talk about it and we'll put together a project. And then they'll figure out a way to sell it. We do some of that like that just because it's let's do this. It's the right thing to do. And then we'll figure out what it means for us later.
Well, for example, it makes perfect sense to me that you have an iPhone app that where I can find out about Macworld gems, right? Stuff that you don't always have room for in the print book. A lot of your reviews are now on the website, and this is another way to get people to those reviews to foster interest by the community in you know little inexpensive software products that are you know really key to this market. It makes sense that be a little destination on my phone when I'm bored, stuck in an airport or a train station or something. I go, oh, I haven't opened this in a while. And then go, hey, this sounds like a cool app. I mean, that wants to be an app because it's about apps. I mean, it makes sense, right?
Right.
As opposed to having a nav, you know, a nav item like gems on your big website and expecting me to go to that on my iPhone. Right.
Right.
Other things I just got, come on. Here we go. What am I looking for? Here we are. I'm not finding it. Okay. It's on my iPad. Here we go. Sorry. In real time, Macworld. I just got Macworld on my iPad, right?
Right.
Which is nice, but it's, I'm not sure what it is yet. Is it your home magazine? Is it the print magazine online? Is it the website? Is it a third thing? I'm not sure. I'm just starting to explore it. And so
Well, if it's the Macworld Daily Reader app for the iPad, it is a third thing.
Right.
And this goes back to your question of at what point should it be an app or should it be a website? And you know, the idea with the Daily Reader is to get back to what I was saying about how our main website is kind of like a fire hose. We've got 20 or 30 stories a day. And then there's this magazine, which is richer and is monthly. And we'll see how it goes. But the idea with the iPad app is, can we create something that's a nice reading experience in the iPad and that's something in between for people who are not interested in reading 30 stories a day about the Mac? So it isn't a reverse chronological list. It's, you know, we're still struggling with the weighting a little bit, but the idea is that the editors are prioritizing stories, and based on this formula that involves how old the story is and how high priority it is, stories shuffle up or shuffle down, with the net effect being that we're picking the stories we think that are more relevant. So like little news stories that kind of fill the transom of the site over the course of the day might not appear in that at all because they're not that important. They're
right.
You know, only important if you want the fire hose. So that was the idea, and also finding a way to explore what it means to be on the iPad and get the visibility that happens when you're in the App Store. And you know, we were on the charts for about a week and it generated a lot of downloads, presumably from people who might not have, you know, be regular readers of the website. But, you know, it is an experiment and an exploration. And, you know, if we were formulating it now, I still think we would do an app because I think there's something to be said for being in Apple's App Store ecosystem. And there's some stuff that is just nicer in the app development framework. There's other stuff that we probably wouldn't do in the app, like the stories. We essentially, our developer had to build a story parser to take our HTML. And so essentially they're building their own web browser. If we had to do that now, we had to make a decision, HTML5 or build our own, like last summer. And we made that decision. It was probably, we made that decision. It was probably the right decision to make at the time based on what we knew. If I was starting that project today, I would say, at that point, let's use WebKit to display an HTML5 view in the app and create kind of a hybrid. But we may do that down the road. I don't know. But that was the rationale behind the app. And it is a different thing that's trying to find a place between the fire hose on the daily website and the or fire hose on the minute-by-minute website and this monthly thing that's richer and curated but, you know, slow because it's only available once a month, which is not often enough.
Have you looked into trees, not for this app, but for future apps? Have you looked at hybrid seems to be a big thing now. Have you looked into like Tree Saver, which is
Oh yeah, I actually forwarded the TreeSaver video to my the person who does mobile development here and our lead developer, and I said, check this out.
Cool.
And when we were talking about it, it was back last summer. It was very hard to get a good example of an HTML, HTML5. Multi-column paginated kind of demo that we could put in the WebKit browser in the iPad. It was hard to see whether that was going to be a good experience or whether it was going to be kind of a poor experience. And so we went with the build it ourselves. And there are limitations to it, because that's what happens when you build a very limited kind of browser. Is you've got to kind of, our feed is very limited in its scope in order to not break it and things like that. But I've looked at that other stuff and it's really cool. I will say one of the reasons why the Daily Reader looks, some of the stories look a little weird, and there's orphans and widows because there's white space when there are images, is if you look at a lot of these iPad apps, like the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever, unless it's something like the Daily where there's obviously a designer laying it out, is they have like a story and then they have a place for a photo with a caption. And what... One of the challenges for Macworld is that we write a lot of stories where our images, first off, we a lot of the stuff we do isn't very conducive to photography. It's screenshots and things because we're writing about software. And a lot of what we do is how-to content where you want to show in context of your story right here, this is what you're going to be looking at while I'm describing it to you. Well, so what we realized is we couldn't build our story pages to pick a random image or even an editorial selected image and show it and then not show any of the other images like what the New York Times does. We couldn't do it that way. The images had to be close to where the text, where they are on the website text, and we weren't going to have a staff of people relaying out every web story for the iPad app. That would be just impossible financially to hire more people to do that. So this is where we went, and that's what makes our challenge a little bit more. The if you look at the TreeSaver demo, you know what they say is, well, there's a layout with three columns and a layout with four columns, and there's an image up here. And our challenge is that, well, we might have one image or no images or five images, and they're going to be in line in the text. And what you really want to do is have the template be intelligent enough to sort of put them in good places and wrap the text around them. And that's a lot tougher. And that's the reason we went with the native browser. But, you know, it still has some weirdnesses about it. So I don't know whether this is all right on the bleeding edge. But, we want to have that same kind of relevance of images to text that the web has. And honestly, a lot of these layouts right now, whether they're app-based or HTML-based, that's something that they punted on, and they've just said, yeah, just stick an image in the corner and then and that's it. And for our content, we kind of can't do that. You can't have a how-to with five steps where only step two appears.
Right. What's your strategy for EPUB?
We started a few years ago, we started a series of these books called Super Guides where we kind of bundle up, like the example I give is, you know, over the course of a year or two, we write all these articles about digital photography, and they're great. But unless you're like taking the magazine and ripping out the pages and putting them in a little folder somewhere, which seems unlikely, some people do that, but it seems unlikely. It's lost. You read one and then it's gone. And so what we started doing is finding these topics and collecting them and updating them and putting them out as books. And so we started as PDFs, and we did some print on demand and some small print runs. And I think that's where we're trying to explore with EPUB as well, is can we make ebooks that are not just like the magazine, but are stuff that we cover in the magazine and on the website that people are interested in, some new stuff, some kind of updated stuff that's already been out there, but collecting it and then and having people pay us for the convenience of having collected it for them in one place. Because, you could find every article we did about digital photography on the website if you did a bunch of searches for it. But how long would that take? And some of the older articles wouldn't be updated. And so that's the idea behind that kind of ebook series.
It's filtering and curation again. It's editorial. It's what you do. So that's cool. And you think you might move into the EPUB format as well?
Yeah, we just started. We did a free iPad book on the iBook store that got huge amount of downloads, and we've got a few on there now. Now it's part of our process that every book we do. We're doing a PDF because I think actually they look really nice. They actually look great on the iPad, and I wish right. the iBooks would let you combine a PDF with an EPUB so that on the iPad you could view the really cool layout version, and then on like an iPhone you could flip over and view the plain text version. They don't let you do that right now. Google right, Books, right. strangely, does, but they don't. So yeah, we're on that, and we're looking at being in the Kindle store and places like that too. So we definitely want to do more of that, and that's what that book line is for. Is sort of the instead of the monthly, you know, in and out with a bunch of different topics. It's can we right. do every couple months? Can we do a focused topic and get it on the you know put it on our site and get it in the iBook store and get it in the Kindle store.
So Jason, I know that we've got to kind of wrap up because you've got a thing.
I got a thing. Yeah.
There's, you know, one of the topics that we talk about a lot, and it's great to have somebody like you on the show who's really, really involved in this, and kind of a big open-ended question, but what is the future of publishing here? I mean, you're wow. you're in, it's a big question, but you're, I mean, here you are, you're running the print magazine, you're involved in running the web magazine, now you're talking about EPUB, and it just, you know, there are different directions here to go, and I mean, really, what are things going to look like, not in a year, but in a handful of years? What are our kids going to think of as publishing in a decade? I mean, you've got kids, you think about that. What yeah. do you think? What is that next generation thing?
That question could not have been more open-ended, as it turns out.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, my first reaction is always to say that a new medium comes around, and initially what you do is something that's an old medium stuck in the new medium's clothes, mm. right? So, right. so you I like know, that. I always say about how when TV was invented, they dragged some cameras into Broadway theater and shot a play, and that was not going to be TV, but that was the best they could come up with at the time.
Right.
And I think we've seen that on the web. We saw that where people were really struggling to find out what the web would be of, you know, in and of itself and not part of TV or newspaper. Papers or magazines or books. And we see that now with these with tablets and phones. I mean, I think that the iPad and all the other devices that are like the iPad that are coming out and smartphones, you know, that's the future of media consumption. And you know, you'll have a digital device that might have a screen of varying sizes, or you might have some different screens that you bring out at various times, the one that's on your wall, the one that's in your bag, and the one that's in your pocket. I don't know. I think that we don't know what the right use of that medium is going to be. Now, I have a guess, right, which is when the iPad came out, we could have said our strategy is going to be, turns out, very much like Time Inc.'s strategy and Condé Nast's strategy, which is we're going to take a paper magazine and stick it on the iPad. And, I don't want to belittle the work they did because they worked sure. hard and they created some interesting products. But the fact is, those the Wired and Sports Illustrated and all that, those are magazines laid out by a person with some whizzy extras that are reminiscent of the CD-ROMs of the 90s and stuck on the iPad. They are extended versions of paper magazines. And that's not going to be what it is. I don't know whether it's going to be – you could argue that what we're doing where we're taking stuff that's sourced from our web content management system and putting it in our iPad app is differently bad in the sense that it too is not native to the iPad in some ways as much as it is sort of taking a web approach. We're trying to vary it, but you could argue that it's still too web-like and it needs to be its own thing. It's early days yet. I don't know. I feel like our approach is the right one compared to that other approach of the digital replica. But we don't know, and it's gonna evolve. And is it going to be app-based or web-based or a hybrid? I mean, from a pure financial standpoint, hybrid – the more HTML5 development you do, the more you can put it on different devices. You know, all this Cocoa stuff, all the Objective-C stuff we did for this app is not really applicable. The UI stuff is, but you know, the rest of it is not. The code's not applicable to Android. If we did HTML5 article view, we might be able to deploy that across all the platforms and then do some other stuff natively. So, you know, I don't know. It's going to be really different, and people. People are going to want to read. People are going to want to watch video. People are going to want to listen to stuff. They're going to want to change between all of those things.
Yeah.
So I think the challenge, if I can frame this open-ended question in this way, I think the challenge is going to be to not be afraid to explore what the new medium offers and try stuff rather than try to jam the old competencies into the new medium, because that's where companies, publishing companies especially, failed and failed to get the web. I mean, Condé Nast is a perfect example. They bought Ars Technica, so that's one for them. But you know, in general, as a company, they failed to understand the web. They never really had a good web presence. And right. I think they felt like the iPad was their opportunity to jump right over the web to the next big medium, except they still are just applying their magazine approach, it seems to me, to the iPad. And you know, I understand why you do that, because that's your core competency. That's who you've got people, you know, you've got designers who understand it. And let's take that, what we're really good at. But, you know, just look at the history of media changes. It doesn't work that way. You can't do that. You got to take what you're good at that is appropriate, but some of the stuff you just got to leave behind. And that's going to be the story of moving to tablets and smartphones and stuff like that, is going to be, you know, accepting the stuff that you can't bring along with you and leaving it behind.
Well, I know you guys gotta go, both of you, but that's some heavy
far out, man,
far out stuff. Yeah. There. No, but I really appreciate it. I know I know it's not every day we get to talk to somebody like you who's really so deep in this industry. So I really do appreciate the insight there, Jeffrey. Well,
absolutely,
and it's an honor to be on the show. I mean, I remember I was coding HTML pages in, believe it or not, in Eudora. Because I didn't think to use some other text editor. I would just open a new window. Wow. And I was coding them by hand in like 1992 and stuff like that. So I have a great respect for the people who build the web too. And you know, I being in tech, you get to be able to mix the, you know, the understanding the tech and also writing about the tech. And that puts me in a really great position, because I get to know people like Jeffrey Zeldman who understand about what how you build this stuff, and also sort of these publishing executives. And it's an interesting place to be, and sometimes it's a little weird, but it is an honor to be asked to be on the show. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Great to have you. Thanks so
great
much.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in. Really appreciate a great show today. And thanks again to Jason. You can follow Jason. Are you Jay Snell? Is he Jay Snell
Jay
on
Snell.
Twitter, right?
Almost everywhere, yes.
And you can listen to your podcast. Tell us about that really quick. You do a podcast too.
Sure. I was going to say we didn't talk. I think last time we all talked, we were talking about the Lost finale.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
I have a podcast called The Incomparable that is a bunch of my friends and colleagues talking about sci-fi, fantasy, TV, movies, all sorts of geeky kind of topics.
Love it.
And you can get it at theincomparable.com or on iTunes.
I love it. All right. So that's it. All right. Thanks so much, Jason. Really do
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Take care, Jeffrey, and everybody who tuned in. Thanks for doing so. We'll be back next week. So have a good one.